You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. One expects both nuance and compassion in the works of the gifted historian Adam Hochschild. King Leopold's Ghost, his superb chronicle of the Rape of the Congo, a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, was a work of history that read like a novel. To End All Wars, which won the Los Angeles Times Book Award and the Penn USA Literary Award, focuses on the long-ignored moral drama of World War I's critics alongside its generals and heroes. In Bury the Chains, he masterfully told the story of the little-celebrated abolitionist movement in Britain and its reverberations throughout modern democracies. In his new book, Spain in Our Hearts, Adam Hochschild considers every facet of the complicated civil war in Spain, using the personal narratives of some of the participants, especially the Americans in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, for elucidation and depth. As historian Michael Kazin pointed out in the laudatory review recently in the New York Times, Hochschild, quote, retells this familiar tale in an unfamiliar and convincing way, as a collective biography that strongly sympathizes with the Americans who fought for and wrote about Republican Spain, but refuses to spare them from criticism. Adam's histories always bring into focus a rich cast of characters, and Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939, is no exception. Told through a dozen characters, including Ernest Hemingway and George Orwell, it's a tale of idealism, heartbreaking suffering, and a noble cause that failed. I look forward to each new book by Adam Hochschild and each of his visits to Aloud to talk about them. Indeed, I looked it up. This is Adam's fourth visit to the Los Angeles Public Library. One of his visits was 2 decades ago. I was here then, too. When he was a guest on our Big Questions series, you can listen to that talk if you go to the podcast page on the Los Angeles Public Library catalog. And at the time, he then addressed the question, why remember, bearing witness to the 20th century? And now Adam Hochschild, the author of 8 books, continues to consider that crucial question, and we're very grateful to him for doing so. In conversation with Adam tonight, we're delighted to welcome back John Wiener, a contributing editor to The Nation magazine, whose books include Historians in Trouble, Plagiarism, Fraud, and Politics in the Ivory Tower, Gimme Some Truth, The John Lennon FBI Files, Professors, Politics, and Pop, and Come Together, John Lennon in His Time, as well as his classic interview with Gore Vidal, I Told You So, Gore Vidal Talks Politics. You probably know John from his afternoon drive time radio show on KPFK 90.7 FM, which features interviews on politics and cultures and is a great contribution to the inquiring minds of our city, many of whom are in this room, I know. Please welcome Adam Hochschild and John Wiener.
Adam, it's nice to be back.
It's great to be here again.
Just remind us, why was there a civil war in Spain?
Okay. Well, roll back the clock to the early 1930s. Spain was actually a bright spot in Europe at that time. It was otherwise a pretty grim scene. Mussolini had been in power in Italy since the 1920s. Hitler came to power in Germany in 1933. There were far-right anti-Semitic regimes in power in much of Eastern Europe. But in 1931, Spain threw off centuries of monarchy and a very recent period of military dictatorship and became a democracy, held nationwide elections, real elections for the first time. And this was celebrated around the world. Progressives everywhere felt further encouraged in early 1936, when a coalition of liberal and left-wing parties won the Spanish national elections. It seemed as if further reforms, land reform especially, were going to move ahead. And then, of course, a shockwave was felt around the world in July of 1936 when a large group of right-wing army officers rose up in revolt against the democratically elected government of the Spanish Republic. They called themselves nationalists. A young general named Francisco Franco soon emerged as their leader. Hitler and Mussolini began funneling them an unending stream of military supplies, advisors, pilots, weapons. Mussolini sent 80,000 ground troops as well.
80,000.
And the Spanish Civil War had begun.
And why did Americans go there to fight? And who were the Americans who went there to fight?
Well, people started streaming to Spain from all over the world to fight for the government of the Spanish Republic because it seemed to everybody that this was a test case of whether fascism would take over yet another country in Europe, with Hitler and Mussolini heavily supporting this nationalist rebellion. Thousands of volunteers went to Spain. The Soviet Union, after several months, got into the act, wanted to try to control, influence, channel this flow of volunteers. Stalin, at that point, seeing the Western democracies hanging back from selling arms to the Spanish Republic, stepped in, started supplying them with arms, and sent orders to communist parties around the world, recruit volunteers to fight in Spain. And one thing you got to say about the Communist Party is when an order went out, they got things done. And eventually some 35 to 40,000 men from over 50 countries volunteered to fight in Spain. And some 2,800 of them were Americans. And I think for all of the Americans, a majority, though by no means all, of the Americans were members or supporters of the Communist Party. But really, for all of them, the major feeling was this is another potential domino in Europe. If another country falls to fascism, Hitler and Mussolini have another ally, it's the advance of, you know, a very ominous force throughout the world. The French writer André Malraux said, fascism has spread its black wings over Europe. And, you know, I think this was really what was motivating the American volunteers. One of them, Maury Colau from New York, said afterwards, for us it was never about Franco, it was always about Hitler.
Mm-hmm. So you say a majority, maybe most of these were either Communist Party members or young communists or so-called fellow travelers, and almost half were Jews. This is a higher proportion than in the American public. How come so many Jews went there?
Well, of course, Jews have always been overrepresented in left-wing movements mm-hmm. everywhere in the world. Hitler was, by this point, making a lot of noises about what he was going to do to the Jews. Jews were also disproportionately represented among political refugees from European countries. So there was also a very high percentage of Jews in these international brigades from other countries as well. Of the Americans, we don't know the numbers for certain because an awful lot of first-generation Jewish immigrants changed their names or had their names changed at Ellis Island, but the estimates are somewhere between a third and half of the Americans were Jewish. And they often found that Yiddish was the lingua franca among people in the international brigades because there were so many other Jews from other countries there. Interestingly, Franco and the nationalists were very anti-Semitic in their rhetoric, even though, of course, there were virtually no Jews in Spain, there having been famously expelled in 1492. But, of course, when the international brigades showed up, this sort of proved Franco's point that there was a Jewish conspiracy against
them. So who were the three groups that Franco saw as the enemy?
Jews, Bolsheviks, and Masons.
The Masons. The Masons. I'd never realized the Masons were such a threat to fascism.
Well,
why were the Masons a major target? Or
because in Spain, they had a tradition of being very anti-clerical. The Catholic Church in pre-1931 Spain was enormously powerful, controlled education in the country, and it was the most reactionary Catholic hierarchy anywhere in Europe. So anybody who was anti-clerical was suspect in the eyes of the nationalists, or anybody who was part of any kind of international movement, be it the Rotary Clubs or Montessori schools or anything that was not purely Spanish. Mm-hmm. People were killed for their membership in such groups.
So when the brigade members got to Barcelona, what did they find in Barcelona in 1936?
Well, Barcelona was a special case because, and the surrounding area, Catalonia, the nearby region of Aragon, because one of the amazing and to me deeply fascinating things about this period of history was that when the Spanish Civil War began, it was both simultaneously a attempted right-wing military coup by Franco and the other generals, but there was also an extraordinary social revolution at the same time, because in much of northeastern Spain, the coup was turned back not by soldiers who remained loyal to the Republic, because most of the army went over to Franco and the Nationalists, but rather by workers' militias that had been organized by left-wing political parties and trade unions. And they successfully defeated the coup attempt in throughout northeastern Spain, and then found themselves essentially in control of a huge swath of the country and put into effect the most far-reaching social revolution ever seen in Western Europe. Workers took over factories. They took over the Ford and General Motors plants in Barcelona, converted them to making munitions that were needed for the front, like armored cars, wonderfully weird, strange-shaped armored cars, you know, fashioned on the spot. Peasants took over these huge estates that they had once worked as landless laborers. Locomotive engineers took over the transportation system, the railway system. At Barcelona's Hotel Ritz, waiters, cooks, and busboys took over the hotel dining room and converted it into People's Cafeteria Number One for the poor. A truly amazing scene, and one of the very few people to describe it was George Orwell, and I'm sure many of you have read his wonderful memoir, Homage to Catalonia, where he describes arriving in Barcelona in December 1936 and seeing all of this and recognizing it, as he put it, as a state of affairs worth fighting for.
And there's also a vivid description of the Ramblas, of walking down the Ramblas and seeing what was on the buildings around there.
Right. Flaming propaganda posters and everything in bright colors, and noticing that people on the street had stopped using the formal terms of address, don and señor and usted. And everybody called you comrade and called you by the second person singular, which in Spanish and French and German, you know, has a much more intimate feel than we don't really have it in English.
So. Quotes from Bakunin on the garbage trucks.
That's right.
I like that part.
That's right.
So we have an anarchist or anarcho-syndicalist revolution in Barcelona and in the Catalan province. We have kind of a liberal social democracy in office in Madrid. And then we have the Soviet Union sending help, let us say, what they thought was help. We have the Communist Party members are the majority of the international brigades. Meanwhile, back in Moscow, Stalin's show trials are beginning. The old Bolshevik heroes of the revolution are being put on trial and are confessing to being agents of Hitler. this is very disturbing and unbelievable to anybody who'd followed the Soviet Revolution. What did the communist members of the brigade make of the news coming from Moscow?
You know, not as much as we would think, because really for men who had volunteered to go to Spain, both from the United States and from Western Europe, I think the fact that they were putting their lives at risk just was much more important to them than anything else. And actually, the defections from the world communist movement, the big splits, largely came later. There were indeed some people in this country and elsewhere who were upset by the Moscow show trials, as they certainly should have been. But it really wasn't until the Hitler-Stalin Pact of 1939 that you had the first really big exodus of people from the Communist Party. And then the really big exodus came in 1956 when Khrushchev made his secret speech denouncing Stalin's crimes. And as I say in the book, this is as if the Pope himself had said the Protestants were right all along. And that's when the big exodus came.
So let's talk for a minute about the sort of geopolitics of the Spanish Civil War. The reason that the Soviet Union was supplying aid is that the United States, England, and France refused. Let's talk about them one at a time. Why didn't France is right across the borders? They have a popular front government. They're certainly aware of the threat of Hitler. The English have to decide what their relationship to Hitler is. And then I'm going to ask you about FDR.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's really an amazing and tragic thing that the three major democracies of the world, and you have to remember a lot of smaller countries followed their lead, did not sell arms to the Spanish Republic. And the Spanish Republic actually had the money to buy those arms because they had the world's fourth largest gold reserve. Because during the First World War, when all the other major nations of Europe were spending themselves deep into debt, Spain, sensibly, was neutral and prospered and traded with both sides and traded with the rest of the world in a way that the belligerent countries couldn't. But each country had its own motives for not wanting to get involved. France, like Spain, was under a Popular Front government, this liberal left coalition. But France was in a state of near civil war. There were riots on the streets in Paris in which people were killed. The man who became prime minister in 1936, Leon Blum, at one point was pulled out of his car and beaten up. There were many generals in the French high command who were quite sympathetic to Franco and the Spanish nationalists. France, to its cabinet, felt like a tinderbox, and they were afraid that if they came in on the side of the Spanish Republic, it might ignite some kind of civil war in France.
Let me just interrupt here. Not only did France refuse to sell arms for gold, there was also the border question. Could you get arms into Spain via France? It's the one obvious way to do it. And most of the time, they didn't allow it.
Right. And after March of 1937, after the Spanish Civil War had been going on 7 or 8 months, France closed the border, which meant that all foreign volunteers for the international brigades from the United States and everywhere else had to climb the Pyrenees to get into Spain, evading French border guards. And there's some extraordinary descriptions of this. It was a very harrowing journey. Basque smugglers guided them on trails. It's estimated that a couple of hundred people died on that journey before they even got to Spain.
All right, what about the Brits?
Britain was under a conservative government at that time, and there were many people in it who sympathized with Franco and the nationalists. Britain had large investments, mining in Spain, and they felt that they would be better off under Franco and the nationalists, a right-wing regime, than they were under the Republic, the Spanish Republic, which allowed free trade unions, which had become quite militant. So Britain just didn't want to get involved.
And I believe there was something called Munich as well.
Well, that came a little bit later, that came in 1938.
It's symptomatic of the British government's view of what to do about Hitler.
Yeah, And of course, France joined in on that also. Appeasement
was their policy, and that was sort of the opposite of fighting fascism in
absolutely.
Spain. Absolutely. FDR is the president. He's married to Eleanor, who's a great fighter for social justice. America certainly has the resources to aid Spain, and lots of Americans understand there's a world struggle coming. Lots of other Americans are what we call isolationists. So what are the politics around FDR? Certainly there are people who are telling him.
Yeah.
Some very good friends of Eleanor's in particular are telling her how urgent it is that the United States supply arms.
Yeah. Well, FDR was a complicated man. He certainly was somebody who understood and hated fascism. At the same time, he was a very shrewd politician. He knew there was very little constituency in the United States for getting involved in a civil war in Europe, whether on the side of the Spanish Republic or the other side. The opinion polls, he was a great reader of opinion polls, and the Gallup polls taken at that era showed that even though more Americans backed the Spanish Republic than backed Franco, the majority of Americans had no opinion about the war, whatever. A much larger proportion of Americans had an opinion about whether King Edward VIII should resign his throne in England to marry the woman he loved.
That was a big one.
So
that was a big
Roosevelt
one.
Felt he had no constituency. It's also believed, although for reasons on both sides, I think this is one of these promises that was never put in writing, but it's widely believed that FDR promised the hierarchy of the American Catholic Church before the 1936 election that he would not sell arms to the Spanish Republic.
We should probably emphasize that the Republic, and especially the revolutionaries, are, can we call them anti-clerical? Is that fair enough?
Profoundly so. Mobs killed nearly 7,000 members of the clergy, the largest such massacre of clergy in modern times.
So the American Catholic hierarchy was the passionate defenders of Franco and of the nationalists, but is it not true that the overwhelming majority of American Catholics voted for FDR?
They did. FDR claimed that if he intervened in favor of the Spanish Republic, he would lose the Catholic vote and lose the election. But I don't think he really believed that. I think he'd made this promise to the Catholic Church. He just felt he had no constituency. He was plainly torn about it. And as the war went on and the Republic, became clear the Republic might lose, he toyed with ideas of getting them arms through third parties in Latin America, was plainly torn about it, but didn't move ahead. And then in January 1939, just a couple months before the war ended and it was clear the Republic was doomed, he said in a cabinet meeting, "We made a grave mistake not to help the Republic." And I think he probably genuinely had come to feel that at this point. Eleanor was certainly a strong lobbyist for helping the Republic, and she kept hinting at this. She wrote a daily newspaper column and kept writing about the suffering of the people of Spain and so on. But in her column, she could never directly criticize one of her husband's policies. But we know something about what she felt because she had a close friend in Spain who was Martha Gellhorn, then Ernest Hemingway's lover, later his third wife.
And one of the stars of your book, Spain in Our Hearts.
And Martha Gellhorn was writing Eleanor a stream of letters from Spain throughout the war, which we now have access to. And finally, I think it was late 1938, the only time that Eleanor allowed herself, even in private correspondence, to sort of hint at her real feelings, she said something to Martha Gellhorn, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's in my book, to the effect that someday I hope I can write you without shame about mm-hmm. American policy.
Very telling
yeah.
moment in this story. So because the United States, England, and France refused to sell arms, the Soviet Union was the only source of support for the Spanish Republic, and that had profound consequences for the politics of the war and life in Barcelona, Madrid, and the other Republican areas.
It did, because you know, Stalin did begin in about 3 months after the war began supplying arms to the Spanish Republic in return for payment. Planes, pilots, tanks, tank drivers, artillery, ammunition, and so on. And it was really this that allowed the Republic to survive another couple of years. Franco would have overrun and captured Madrid in the fall of 1936. Had it not been for these arms and for the international volunteers. But in return for this, Stalin demanded and got high positions for Spanish and Soviet communists, both in the Spanish Republic Army High Command and in the security forces. And these folks were very much against this social revolution centered on Barcelona, I think for a mixture of good and bad reasons. I think and it was a peculiar alliance between the communists, who rapidly gained influence in Spain at this time, having had only very few members in the national legislature at the time the war began, between the communists and the mainstream liberal parties of the Republic, who were no enthusiasts of revolution to begin with. The communists wanted a revolution, if there was to be one, controlled from the top down, as it happened in Russia, and not something bubbling up from the bottom in the anarchist spirit, which was happening in Barcelona. And they wanted to control what happened. But I do think they had a reasonable point that it's not a good idea to try to make a revolution at the same time as you're fighting a war against an army heavily backed by Hitler and Mussolini.
This, of course, is a controversial issue on the left even today.
True.
Does the revolution have to wait until after the war, or is the revolution the secret to building the spirit, the solidarity, the comradeship that you need to win the war? Spain is one example of how that worked out.
Well, interestingly, somebody who changed his mind about this in an interesting way was George Orwell.
You know, let's just go back for a minute here. So the main way most of us learned this whole story is from Homage to Catalonia. Mm-hmm. He arrived from England. He saw the conflict between the Communist Party, which is against the revolution, strangely enough, mm-hmm. and this group, the PUM, P-O-U-M, the Marxist Workers' Party of Unification. Let's talk just for a minute about Orwell, his arrival, his observations, and his writing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Homage to Catalonia remains one of my favorite books. He gives a vivid description of what life in revolutionary Barcelona was like. And then later on, of course, then he spends 3 months at the front. Then he's back in Barcelona on leave, actually trying to transfer to the international brigades, because even though they were controlled by the Communist Party, which he didn't like, they were fighting in defense of Madrid, which he felt was the real battle of the war.
He was in a militia of PUM.
PUM, which was a small party, small left-wing party, sort of semi-allied with the nationalists, but it was a party particularly hated by Stalin because a couple of its leaders were former communists who lived in the Soviet Union and defected. And, you know, a heretic Stalin was not somebody who tolerated any heresy at all. But Orwell, at the time that he wrote Homage to Catalonia, and he started writing it as soon as he went back to England after being severely wounded in the war, he felt what you just said, John, that, you know, if you had revolutionary spirit, this is what would rouse people to successfully defeat the nationalist coup attempt. And he said so in the book. And he said, if this revolution hadn't been suppressed, which it was, we could have won. By 5 years later, he'd changed his mind about this. And in an essay he wrote in 1943 called Looking Back on the Spanish War, he said essentially what almost all historians would agree with today, which is that the Spanish nationalists won because they were being heavily backed by Hitler and Mussolini, and the democracies had done nothing in defense of the Republic. And actually, before Orwell died in 1950, he left instructions for Homage to Catalonia to be rearranged accordingly. He didn't want to unsay anything he'd said in the book, but he wanted two lengthy chapters about the factional infighting move to become appendices. His British publisher didn't carry this out until 35 years later, and his American publisher was only made aware of this by me and reissued the book in the proper form last year.
We thank you. Thank you for that. Homage to Catalonia has one of the... He recounts what, for many of us, is really the darkest hour of the Spanish Republic, not just the fascist forces defeating the forces of democracy, but the moment where the Republican government turns on the anarchist workers of Barcelona in this gun battle at the telephone exchange at the Plaza Catalunya.
Yeah.
Terrible, terrible moment. And he appreciated just what it meant.
He did. He saw a revolution that had deeply moved him being suppressed. And, you know, I have mixed feelings about it myself, I must say, because I think that there's something enormously utopian and inspiring and fascinating about Spanish anarchism and all of these things I described, you know, workers taking over factories and, you know, peasants taking over the land and so on. I mean, these are the kinds of things that radicals and dreamers have been, you know, thinking and talking and advocating for centuries. At the same time, mixed in with it were a lot of other things. For example, the Spanish anarchists had a deep hostility to the use of money as a means of exchange, and they burned piles of paper money. Now, you know, this is an interesting thing to try doing, but when you're in a war against people who are backed by Hitler and Mussolini, I think there maybe ought to be other things that would be higher up on the agenda. They did a lot of other stuff as well that was...
And of course, behind all of this politics of the revolution and the revolution is the question of FDR. One of the reasons that Stalin gives orders to suppress and destroy the anarchist revolution is that he knows this is scaring away certainly the Brits mm-hmm. and some of the French and almost certainly the Americans. They don't want to support, they don't want to arm revolutionary workers to seize the factories, but maybe if those workers weren't so revolutionary, maybe FDR will send arms. And on the other hand, if FDR, to me, the worst thing about FDR refusing to arm the Republic is that meant Stalin was going to have political control yeah. over the fate of the Republic and of the yeah. people of Barcelona.
Yeah. Well, it was not only the communists, but also the mainstream parties of the Republic that
yes.
felt that if Spain were perceived by Britain, France, and the U.S. as a revolutionary society, there wouldn't be a prayer of getting those countries to sell it arms. As it turned out, there wasn't a prayer anyway,
yeah.
even after they suppressed the revolution. That was the
big sigh. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the fascist side. Let's talk about Texaco.
Okay. All right. Well, this was one of the discoveries for me in researching this book that was really fascinating and horrifying to dig into. And it's something that if you read, histories of the Spanish Civil War, like Hugh Thomas's famous and quite good comprehensive history of the war, you'll often see a footnote saying that Franco received most of his oil supply from Texaco during the war. But there's a lot more to that story because just that fact in itself should raise questions for historians and should have raised questions for this very numerous and glamorous crew of foreign correspondents in Spain at this time, Hemingway, Gellhorn, and all the others, for this reason. Modern militaries run on oil. You need oil, aviation gasoline for planes and diesel fuel for tanks and trucks and, 60% of the oil going to either side in Spain during the war was used by the rival armies and air forces. But nationalist Spain had no oil wells. Hitler and Mussolini, who were supplying it with a steady stream of arms and,
Planes, tanks, pilots,
Gestapo interrogators and everything else. Hitler and Mussolini were oil importers, not exporters. Would have been very expensive for them to pay for all of Franco's oil. The chief source of oil in the world at that time was the United States, especially the state of Texas. But American neutrality legislation was quite strict and said that any goods, not just arms, but any goods going to a country at war could not travel on American ships, and nationalist Spain had no tankers. And any goods going to a country at war could not be sold on credit, and the nationalists had very little cash on hand. But this was not a problem for Franco because he had a great admirer who happened to be CEO of Texaco, one of the biggest American oil companies. A man named Torkild Reber, originally an immigrant from Norway, who was somebody who liked right-wing dictators, big admirer of Franco, of Hitler, later on of the Shah of Iran, at one point in his life tried to fund a right-wing military coup in Mexico. Very colorful, rather nasty guy. And he said to Franco, no problem, we will sell you the oil on credit. That was the first violation of oil, of U.S. law. He shipped the oil to Spain in Texaco tankers.
Isn't that against the law?
It was against the law.
But
what these tankers would do, they would load up at the Texaco pipeline terminal in Port Arthur, Texas. And when customs officials boarded, they would be shown paperwork proving that the tanker was headed for Rotterdam or Amsterdam or Antwerp. And then at sea, their captains would open sealed orders redirecting them to ports in nationalist Spain. But he did a couple of other things as well that were only discovered in recent years by a Spanish scholar, Guillermo Martinez, who written about it in Spain and very generously shared his documents with me. Texaco sold this oil to Franco at a huge discount, pricing it as if the nationalist Spaniards were transporting it in their own tankers instead of Texaco paying the cost of transporting it across the Atlantic. And Reber, the CEO of Texaco, never shared that information with Texaco shareholders. It's not mentioned in the company's annual reports. And as far as we can tell from the minutes of their meetings, he never even shared it with his own board of directors. He also did something else, which was that, like any multinational oil company, Texaco had loading docks, tank farms, installations, agents in ports all over the world. And in the oil business, as in any other business, people know what their competitors are up to, and it's pretty obvious if an oil tanker is taking on a cargo somewhere. He sent out orders to Texaco people in ports everywhere saying, send us information as quickly as you can get it about oil shipments heading for the Spanish Republic. Name of the tanker, date of departure, port they're heading for, and so forth. This information was passed on to the Nationalist High Command so that bomber pilots and submarine captains looking for targets would know what to look for. There were 29 oil tankers heading for the Spanish Republic that were sunk, damaged, or captured over the course of the war. And in one or two cases, we can directly trace it to information supplied by Texaco. So an amazing thing. America's supposedly neutral. Here's an American company supplying strategic military intelligence to one side in the Civil War.
Let's talk about Hitler.
Okay.
The big question to me about Hitler is Hitler's whole thinking, his whole strategic plan is to move east, mm-hmm. to colonize Eastern Europe, to get oil from the Mideast. Was it just that he liked Francisco Franco? What did Spain, why, what did Hitler get out of, was this just a altruistic, generous thing that Adolf Hitler did for Francisco Franco?
No, it's true that Hitler was always aiming east. He wanted to conquer Eastern Europe. He wanted to show the Russians who was boss. He wanted to take the Balkan and Caspian oil fields. The Spanish Civil War took him by surprise, as it did most people. But he immediately saw Franco as an ideological ally. He saw Spain as a source for crucial materials, strategic minerals, very important in, you know, steel alloys, things that pyrites and other minerals that were extremely important in weapons manufacturing. And Franco sent him an envoy, a pair of envoys, requesting his help within a week or so after the coup. And Hitler immediately responded.
Tell us the scene.
Hitler was at a performance of a Wagner opera at the opera festival in Bayreuth. And Franco's envoys arrived after the performance and were ushered in to see Hitler, who then kept the rest of his entourage waiting for dinner while he spoke with these people, and apparently spent the first portion of the hour or so he talked to them railing against Spain for having stayed neutral in the First World War. But then he agreed to supply the arms that they wanted, in fact, supplied even more than they had asked for.
And he named the operation?
Operation Magic Fire.
After the Wagner opera.
And and what he got in return were a couple of things. He got a guarantee of these Spanish strategic minerals, which are very important for building up the Wehrmacht. In fact, the first German ship that took disassembled aircraft and so on to nationalist Spain returned with a cargo full of the products of Spanish mines. And this continued, and each successive stage of armaments was paid for in that form. But it was also, for Hitler, the Spanish War was a very important chance to try out all the weapons that he was preparing for the much larger war that he was already then, in 1936, planning on launching. So all of the German weapons we know from World War II, the Messerschmitt 109 fighter plane, the Stuka dive bomber, the 88-millimeter artillery piece, all were used extensively for the first time in combat in Spain. And you can actually, you know, see these weapons through the eyes of the American volunteers who, like other volunteers, were their targets.
I was also very interested in your stories about the New York Times, which, first of all, how many page one articles did you find in the New York Times?
Well, this was a huge news story. And this was one of the parts of the book that, working on it, that fascinated me most, because I've done some reporting from overseas myself and occasionally from conflict zones, and always very interested in how journalists cover stories, how they become part of the stories that they're covering, what they miss. There were more than 1,000 page one stories in the New York Times about the Spanish Civil War during the period that it went on from mid-1936 to early 39.
Almost one a day.
Yeah.
1,000 over 3 years. And how does this compare with
coverage? Actually, a little more than one a day, is more stories than on any other subject.
Any other subject.
Whether the rise of Hitler, the re-election of President Roosevelt, the toll of the Great Depression.
Now, what fascinated me here was the New York Times had two reporters there. Did that make the coverage twice as good?
It made it very contentious, because the Times very diligently, and this Times-like fashion, it has set out to cover the war from both sides. And on the side of the Republic was a very well-known reporter, Herbert Matthews, who became a good friend of Ernest Hemingway, who became a passionate defender of the Spanish Republic, blind to any faults it had, but just a very, very passionate partisan. Similarly, on the other side, on the side of the nationalists, was a Times reporter named William P. Carney, who not only became a passionate defender of the Spanish nationalists, but after he retired from the Times, got a job as a paid propagandist for Franco in the United States. And these two hated each other and sniped at each other indirectly in the pages of the paper. And it's always fun when you can see people doing this in, and they're forced to do it very indirectly. For example, at one point, Matthews, in a way, was the better reporter because he had a reputation well-earned among the soldiers for always being at the front lines, being in the trenches, and so on. On the nationalist side, that was much harder for a journalist to do. They like to keep people away from the French side. And Carney, anyway, was somebody who sort of preferred to report from the safety of the rear or the cities in southern Spain, like Seville and so on, which were quite far from the action, and relied more on Franco's press releases. And at one point in late 1937, early 1938, there was a fierce battle for the city of Teruel, which was actually the first provincial capital captured by the Republic's army in an advance they made in late 1937. And at one point, Carney, writing from the nationalist side, reported that Teruel had been recaptured by the nationalists. Matthews, who was reporting from the Republican side, knew this was not true, went to Teruel, where he'd been a number of times already, wrote a dispatch datelined from the city saying that it was in Republican hands, and then ended by saying, in this war, some things can be learned only by seeing them with your own eyes, which everybody knew was a jab of his elbow in the side of Carney. So it's wonderful to sort of trace that rivalry in the pages of the time.
Now, this takes me back to George Orwell, who's writing about being in battle and what was going on in Spain was very different from these guys.
Well, Orwell was actually at the front.
He was at the front, and nevertheless, he didn't claim to know what was going on.
Yeah. Another virtue of Homage to Catalonia, yeah, in my mind, is its humility. Orwell says in the book, you know, I can only report what I see, and I can only see one corner of events. And there are very few writers reporting from abroad. You know, it's sort of the fashion among foreign correspondents and pundits and columnists. You report on a complicated conflict somewhere, you want to sound as if you understand it completely. And Orwell, who had lived and fought there for 3 or 4 months, was not trying to do that. He was being honest about what he knew and what he didn't know. And as I mentioned before, he wasn't afraid to change his mind.
I wanted to ask you to read one of my favorite passages. It's the mark on top here. Let's just set this up a little bit. So the international brigades suffer horrible losses. War as hell barely even describes what the international brigades went through, not enough to eat. What proportion of them were injured or killed?
Of the Americans, the 2,800 Americans, more than, and I'm not sure we really have accurate statistics on the whole international brigades, but it's probably pretty similar. Of the 2,800 Americans, 750 were killed, which is more than one out of four, and a majority of the remainder were wounded, some of them quite seriously.
So no other American wars had anything like this.
Far higher.
Maybe
than
the Civil War,
but
no.
Far higher rate than World War I or World War II.
And close to the end, the Republican government made a decision to withdraw the international brigades. Why did they decide to do that?
There were only a few thousand men left at that point in the international brigades. They were exhausted, battle weary. They were by this point a very small proportion of the Republic's manpower, and the Republic, which was grasping at straws, was desperately hoping that if they made this public gesture, that then the Western democracies would put pressure on Franco to, you know, withdraw Mussolini's troops, which, as I said, over the course of the war totaled 80,000. It didn't work. but they still withdrew. They withdrew the international brigades.
So the international brigades were withdrawn. They left from Barcelona, and you describe the international brigade's departure from Barcelona.
So I'll just read these couple of paragraphs. From packed sidewalks, from windows and crowded balconies draped with flags, and from precarious footholds on sycamore trees and lampposts, 300,000 Spaniards wept, cheered, waved, and threw flowers, confetti, and notes of thanks. It was October 28, 1938, and 2,500 troops from what was left of the international brigades were marching down the Diagonal, one of Barcelona's grand avenues, for an official farewell. Along the boulevards were signs with the names of battles in which the volunteers had fought. The brigades had borne the brunt of so much combat that their soldiers had been killed at nearly three times the rate of the rest of the Republican Army. Many of the internationals still in Spain were in hospitals, but men from 26 countries made it to the parade. The gaunt files of marchers could barely be seen over the heads of the vast crowds who turned out to cheer them. The 2,800 Americans who marched included a handful of nurses from the medical detachment. The rest were men who came along the avenue with blanket rolls slung over their right shoulders, the shabbiest of uniforms and mismatched footgear. They walked nine abreast, sometimes ankle-deep in flowers. As the volunteers marched through the city, they could see the gutted buildings and peeled away apartment house walls that bore testimony to Mussolini's intensive bombing raids earlier in the year. Republican fighter planes flew overhead on guard against new attacks. Bands played but could barely be heard. The women and children were jumping into our arms, remembered a New York volunteer, calling us sons, brothers, calling, come back. I never had such an experience, because these men, such tough fighters, every last one of them was crying. Milton Robertson, a medical student wounded at the Ebro, was in a group of internationals who were driven to the parade from a hospital. The roar of cheering was continuous, he wrote home the next day. It was like a wave that never broke but poured on. A little boy, 9 or 10 years old, stood on the corner. Tears streaked a dirty line down his face. He saw our truck bearing down, saw the bandages flash about. He dashed out, met the truck, and clambered up the side. Tears still streaming down his face, he thrust his arms about me and kissed me on both cheeks. I kissed him, tasting his tears.
Adam Hochschild, Spain in our hearts. Last question, the title, Spain in our hearts. Where does that come from?
It comes from a quotation. Oh, good, you found it for me, because I should know this by heart, and I don't. It comes from something said by, written by Albert Camus some years after the war, where he said, "Men of my generation have had Spain in our hearts. It was there that they learned that one can be right and yet be beaten, that force can vanquish spirit, and that there are times when courage is not rewarded."
Well, let's open it up to questions. First of all, I have a question. How many people, is there anyone here who has had family, friends, or relatives who were in the brigades? Or let's see, hands up, hands high. How many have we got? Let's let those people ask a question first.
Yes.
Who would like to go first? Way in the back. Wait for the microphone, please. And I repeat, you heard Louise Steinman say, if possible, make it a question.
Yes, sir. Any survivors left alive?
No, the last known American survivor, Delmer Berg of California, died last month.
And did he get to see your book?
Unfortunately not. He died at the age of 100.
Okay, any others with family members or friends who were in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade who would like to comment or ask a question? How about right down here?
There you go. First, let me say I'm not a lover of Stalin. But I also want to say that, I would think that a number of the people who volunteered for the brigade volunteered because they believed and had thought it through and volunteered from that perspective, not because they were ordered by Stalin to do it. So I think when we say those things, we kind of tarnish the heroism and the individuality of many of, you know, the young people who were members of the party and those who were supporters and those who weren't. So, I mean, I think we should be cautious and not give in and not make use of those kinds of slogans when we talk about this. Thanks.
Okay. Back here. Man with many books.
I just want to say both my parents were in the Civil War. They met over in Spain.
Wow.
My father was a truck and ambulance driver, and my mother was a nurse. Mm. My father was one of those people that climbed the Pyrenees, and my mother was able to, because she was part of the International Red Cross, was actually able to get in legally. But, and as you mentioned about Yiddish, my mother, you know, both my parents were Jewish, and my mother did speak Yiddish. And one of the doctors that she worked with was a Polish Jew, and that was the way they communicated.
She worked for Dr. Grunblatt.
Possibly.
Jacques Grunblatt.
This was in Benicassim in the south of Spain.
Yeah.
Anyway, my question is, I'm sure you've come across the archives of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. Were those valuable in any of your research?
Enormously so. And
where are the archives of the American Lincoln?
They're in the Tamament Library of New York University. And if any of you who are family members of Lincoln Brigaders here still have any letters, diaries, documents, papers, and are looking for where to give them, I heartily recommend this archive.
We love the Tamament.
Yeah, it's a wonderful library. It's an archival unit within the New York University library system. And from a historian's point of view, it's extremely well-organized, user-friendly, easy to use, cross-indexed in a very useful way. There are more than 200, well over 200 American volunteers whose papers of one sort or another are there. Diaries, letters, other documents, which means that really for close to 1 out of 10 of the Americans, we've got some sort of, you know, documentation that they've left behind. So it was a very rich trove of material for me to work from, and I spent many days there. Another kind of material that was there, which was fascinating for me to work from, was this. You know, anybody who's been in the military knows that armies run with vast amounts of paperwork, and the international brigades were no exception. When the brigades were withdrawn, all of their written records were taken back to Moscow, where they remained locked up for more than half a century. After the Soviet Union fell apart, the Russians realized there was money to be made by microfilming this stuff and selling it to Western libraries. And NYU has something like 185 microfilm reels of the personnel records of all of those American volunteers, sometimes up to, you know, 25 or 30 pages, autobiographical statements that people wrote, their military records, where they were, comments that commanders and other people wrote about them, in a variety of languages. Because the international brigades were international. One of the characters in my book, I looked through his file there. There were 25 pages on him. Happily for me, most of it written in English, but also comments in French, Spanish, German, and Russian.
Wow.
Again, fascinating material for historians to work with.
Okay, way back here. Is that okay? Sorry to make you and we had somebody else over here. They'll find them.
Okay.
I don't have to point.
Hi. I have two questions. One question real quick is, there were accusations over time that there was a lot of yellow journalism and a lot of promoting of the war by Randolph Hearst and trying to financially take advantage of the war because he made a lot of money off of it. So I'm wondering if you could address any of that. And also, militarily, when we have American volunteers going abroad, how does that work out in a military sort of general soldier ranking, like who's in charge, all of that sort of thing? Thank you.
Okay. The first question about Hearst making money off the war, I think you're thinking about the Spanish-American War, not the Spanish Civil War, where Hearst made his famous remark, was it? What was it? You furnished the... You supply the pictures, I'll supply the
thank
war.
You,
yeah, thank you. Okay, that was 1898. That was previously. The second question about who was in charge, who the command were, was, the American unit, you know, actually the phrase Lincoln Brigade, it didn't actually exist at the time. There was a Lincoln Battalion, then there was a George Washington Battalion, then they were combined after they both suffered heavy losses. They became the Lincoln-Washington Battalion. There was also a battalion that had the names of two Canadian patriots, but in fact, most of the people in it were Americans. And then there was an American medical unit. But after they all came home, they began collectively referring to themselves as the Lincoln Brigade. But anyway, when they were there in combat, these American volunteers had American officers, as did the British volunteers have British officers and the French volunteers had French officers, but they served under the high command of the Spanish Republic's army.
And say a few words about the American commander. Very interesting guy.
Yeah, this was, you know, I like to try to deal with a period of history like this by focusing in on 10 or 12 people, and hopefully people who knew each other, loved each other, hated each other, were involved with each other in some way, and follow their stories through this period. And two of the people I follow through this period are an American couple, Bob and Marion Merriman.
They were not Yiddish speakers.
They were not Yiddish speakers. They were perhaps atypical in that sense. They were WASPs. They had attended college together at the University of Nevada at Reno, got married on graduation day in 1932, and then moved to Berkeley, where Bob Merriman was a graduate student in economics for several years, actually together with John Kenneth Galbraith, who was a great admirer of his. And when I was looking through their papers, I almost fell off my chair when I saw the address where they lived, because it's about three or four blocks from where I live today, and every time I walk from my house to the Graduate School of Journalism at Berkeley, where I teach a class, I walk past the building where they live. They ended up in Spain, both of them, Marion, the only American woman in uniform at International Brigade's headquarters, working as a clerk. Bob was one of the very few Americans in Spain who had any military training, because when he was working his way through college at the University of Nevada, he discovered you could earn an extra $8.50 a month, which was a lot of money in the Depression, by taking ROTC. So when he got to Spain, they saw he was one of the very few Americans that had any military training. He became commander of the American Battalion. Then was wounded, recovered, and became chief of staff of the 15th International Brigade, which was the unit that was included American, British, and Canadian volunteers, and some from other countries as well.
And what happened to him?
He disappeared in combat in the spring of 1938. His body was 1938. His body was never found.
It's one of the most heartbreaking stories that you tell, is the anxiety about what's happened to him, and rumors that he was still alive.
And for months there were rumors, and he'd been enormously popular among everybody who met him in Spain, the correspondents, the American military attaché, Spanish anarchists, people of all political stripes felt this man's charisma. Somebody else who clearly felt his charisma and who knew him well was Ernest Hemingway. And there are many of Merriman's characteristics in the hero Robert Jordan in For Whom the Bell Tolls, a former university instructor from the American West who loses his life in Spain, tall, fair-haired, various other details. Anyway, his wife Marion never knew exactly how he died. He was leading a group of men, Americans, Spaniards, volunteers from other countries, in a on a disastrous retreat from a nationalist offensive in the spring of 1938. They reached a hilltop where they knew they had to cross a valley and a mountain range, and then they would be in the Republic's territory on the other side. But as they reached this hilltop and saw the valley, it was full of nationalist troops. They realized they were surrounded. They broke up into smaller groups to try to infiltrate through. Most of them didn't make it. She never knew how he died. But 49 years after his death, she got a letter one day from a former Spanish soldier who said, "I had to keep my head down all the years of the dictatorship, but now I can contact you. I served under your husband. I admired him. I was with him when he was killed, and here's where it was." 49 years after the fact, anybody's memory is a little shaky. There are other people who were around then who say, no, it wasn't there. It was a few miles over here. But still, this letter seemed to bring her some peace, and she died a few years later in her 80s. And when I went to Spain researching the book, I went to that hilltop to see what it looked like from there. Beautiful scene today, but it must have been a terrifying one to see this valley full of nationalist troops then.
Another question, yes.
Yes. So did you look at what happened to the internationals when they came back to their countries? And I know this is like about the American Brigade mostly, but were there differences in how they were treated when they came back? Because these guys had the most recent military experience as, you know, in the opening days of World War II.
They had a pretty hard time in most countries. In Britain, for example, for British volunteers, their government evacuated them from France, where they had gone from Spain, brought them across the English Channel, and then subsequently, in late 1940, tried to charge them for their passage, send them a bill for their passage. And one British soldier said, I'll pay that bill if you'll also send a bill to everybody you evacuated from Dunkirk. The American volunteers generally had a rough time. Some of them had their passports confiscated when they landed at the dock in New York. The FBI, this was, of course, the era of J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI sent agents to question them for years, decades afterwards, sent agents to question their employers. World War II, of course, began, and the United States entered World War II only a couple of years after the end of the Spanish War. More than 400 Lincoln veterans served in the American Armed Forces in World War II, and over 20 of them were killed. Their experience in the armed forces varied according to their commanding officer. Some commanding officers were very suspicious, you know, oh, you're in Spain, you must be a communist or something, and people were sent to spend their time peeling potatoes. Other commanding officers were smart enough to realize that here were men with recent military experience, which very few American soldiers had at that point. One particularly moving story about someone in the American Armed Forces is this. There was an Englishman named Bernard Knox, who later became a very distinguished professor of classics at Yale, who fought in the Spanish Civil War and then immigrated to the U.S. immediately after the war, after the Spanish War. When World War II began, he joined the OSS. At one point was parachuted, I believe, behind the lines in Italy as liaison to the Italian partisans who were fighting Mussolini. And as he writes in a description of this, he said when he met this partisan unit for the first time, he said, "My newly acquired Italian kept getting mixed up with my half-forgotten Spanish." And suddenly the partisan leader across the room looked at him and said, "Spain." And they realized they had both fought in the defense of Madrid.
Do you see any parallel between the Western democracies not supporting the Republicans in Spain, and today we're not supporting, let's say, the rebels in Syria or the Kurds in northern Iraq?
Well, I am wary about interventions generally, and I don't think I would have advocated in the 1930s the U.S. actually intervening in Spain. I just would have advocated American willingness to sell arms to an elected regime in a country that was trying to defend itself against a military coup. Syria is such a complicated situation. I know there have been, you know, efforts made, you know, by people inside and outside the U.S. government to, you know, identify rebels there who are worth supporting. I don't feel I know enough about it to make those distinctions.
We have been trying to arm the democratic resistance.
Yeah.
It's very hard to find a democrat.
But I'm not sure how many of them there really are.
Yeah.
So I am cautious about those kinds of interventions.
Last question.
My father, who worked in the Pentagon in World War II, said that files of people who had served in the Lincoln Brigade or in Spain were marked prematurely anti-fascist. Is that true?
You know, there's a lot of argument about this because there are people who say that they have seen these files, and that was actually a U.S. government designation in the military records of you know, people who went to Spain. Then there are right-wing historians who say, no, that's not true. This is something that the lefties made up after the war. The problem is you can't solve the argument because there was a fire that destroyed virtually all of World War II-era U.S. personnel records. However, in trying to trace this phrase back as far as I could find it,
yes,
on the written record using something that we have today that was not a tool available 20 or 30 years ago, which is huge numbers of digitized newspapers, I did find a record of a member of Congress saying in 1946 that his right-wing colleagues were using this term, premature anti-fascist. That's as far back as I've been able to find it on the written record. It may well have gone back further, and your dad was perhaps right.
Well, this was Martin Dies, the first chairman of the House Un-American Activities Committee,
yeah,
called the Lincoln Brigade members premature,
yeah,
anti-fascists. I am sorry we are out of time. It's been a wonderful evening. Thank you, Adam Hochschild. And thanks to everybody.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.